Many of his most valuable men were former guerrillas, captured and skillfully turned by Rhodesian intelligence. So, as they ran on, he studied Comrade China with renewed interest. He was probably a few years younger than Sean. He had refined, Nilotic features, more Ethiopian than Shona, a narrow, high-bridged nose and chiselled lips, rather than the broadly negroid. Even the morphine could not dim the intelligence of his large, dark eyes. He was a handsome man, and of course he would be tough and utterly ruthless. He would not have reached this rank were he not. "I want him," Sean decided. "My God, he would be worth another full regiment to us." And he tightened his grip on the man's arm, a proprietorial gesture. "This little darling is going to get the full treatment." The vanguard ran into a Frelimo patrol in the middle of the morning and brushed them aside, hardly slackening their pace to do so. The corpses in their blotched Frelimo camouflage lay beside the track as they trotted past. They came up with a troop convoy a little after midday. The trucks were guarded by the Eland armoured cars, and they had cans of ice-cold castle beer in the cool boxes. The scouts had covered 42 miles in just over 7 hours, and the beer tasted like nectar. Sean gave a can to Comrade China. "Sorry about your ear," he told him, and saluted him with a beer can. "I would have done the same to you." China smiled, but his eyes were inscrutable. "To our next meeting," he suggested the toast. "Until we meet again," Sean agreed, and handed him over to a guard detail under a white sergeant. Then he climbed into the command armoured car to lead the final stage of withdrawal. Sean extricated his column and had them back across the border 10.5 hours after the attack began. Ian Smith, the Prime Minister, came on the radio in person to congratulate him and inform him of his decoration, a bar to his Silver Cross. Sean didn't learn about Comrade China's escape until the column went into Laga that evening. Apparently China had slit the canvas hood of the troop truck and slipped through it while his guard was dozing. Undeterred by his manacles, he had dropped off the speeding truck, screened by the dust boiling out from the back wheels, and rolled into the head-high elephant grass along the verge. 2 months later, Sean had seen an intelligence report that placed China in command of the successful attack that had wiped out a supply convoy on the Mount Darwin Road. "Yes, Matatu, I remember it all very well," Sean answered his question, and made one more steep turn above the site of the old terrorist base before he returned the Beechcraft to straight and level flight on a southerly heading. He did not, however, fly as far southwards as the railway line that linked the port of Beira to the landlocked Zimbabwe border. This was a focus for all the military and rebel activity in the area, and the countryside would be swarming with Frelimo and Zimbabwean troops, all armed with RPG rockets, and eager to get a shot in an unmarked, low-flying aircraft with no flight authorization. "At least," Sean told Job, "it looks like a possibility." Job agreed. "The border opposite our camp seems undefended and deserted." "Worth a try for 500,000? Sean asked, and Job just grinned at him. "One more little chore before we go home," Sean told him. It required precise navigation and an eye for the terrain, but Sean crossed back into the Zimbabwean side, and flying low they were able to pick out the spot where the previous day they had first come across the poachers' tracks. From that point, with Matatu craning his head to see down and calling directions, they found the tableland and valley where they had come up with a band of poachers and taken them under fire. From the air, the distances seemed much shorter than they had on foot. Matatu directed Sean along the trail the old bull had made towards the border. It seemed that his gift for direction and terrain was not impaired by height above the ground, and Sean was following their course on the map that he held on his lap. "We're crossing back into Mozambique now," Sean was scribbling notes on the map. "This way." Matatu leaned over the back of the seat and pointed out a more northerly track. Shaw knew better than to argue with him, and turned a few degrees left. Minutes later, Matatu demanded he turn slightly south again. Little bugger's actually sensing the old bull's trail. He's thinking like the elephant. Shaun marvelled, and at that moment, Matatu gave a squeak of triumph and pointed urgently out of the side window. As they flashed across another dry riverbed, Shaun glimpsed the tracks trodden in the soft sand. They were so deep that they were filled with shadow, a string of dark beads on the white background. Even Shaun, who for 20 years had watched Matatu work, was amazed. On instinct alone, Matatu had followed the bull to this river crossing. It was a supernatural feat. Shaun circled the tracks, his port wingtip pointing directly at them, so steep was his turn. "Which way now?" he called to the back seat, and Matatu tapped his shoulder and pointed downstream. Without demur, Shaun followed the gnarled black finger. "There he is!" Job shouted suddenly, and Matatu shrieked with laughter and clapped his hands, bouncing in his seat like a child at the pantomime. A mile ahead, the river ran into a wide flay that still held water from the last rains. The elephant's humped back showed above the tops of the tall reeds that surround the pool, like a grey whale in a sea of green. As they raced low towards him, the elephant heard the Beechcraft's engine. He lifted his head and spread his ears wide, turning to face them. And they saw his tusks, those legendary shafts of black ivory raised to the sky. The beauty of their curved symmetry struck Shaun all over again. There was just a glimpse of them as they flashed overhead, but the image was printed vividly on his mind's eye. $500,000... And those tusks. He had risked his life 100 times for much lesser prizes. "Going back for another look?" Job asked, twisting his head to try and see back over the tailplane. "No," Shaun shook his head. "We don't want to disturb him more than necessary. We know where to find him. Let's go home." "It's my $500,000 that you're so gaily throwing around," Claudia told her father. "How do you work that out?" Ricardo asked. He was lying on his camp bed, dressed in a pair of silk pajama bottoms, his chest and his feet bare. Claudia noticed that most of his body hair was still crisp, curly and black, with only a patch of fuzzy grey in the centre of his chest. "My inheritance," she explained sweetly. "You are blowing my inheritance, Papa." Ricardo chuckled. She had the sass of a divorce lawyer, coming bursting into his tent to renew the argument which he thought he'd finalised in the mess tent over breakfast. "If I'm not going to get it in your will, the very least you can do is let me enjoy it with you now. According to the last audit, young lady, you will have a little over $36 million coming to you after taxes, and after I've allowed myself the small extravagance. I hasten to add that every cent is tied up in a trust fund that not the most crafty lawyers will ever break. I don't want you handing my hard-earned loot out to one of your bleeding-heart charities."
"Papa, you know the money has never interested me.
What interests me is coming with you on this crazy jaunt after the elephant. I came to Africa with you on the understanding that I was to be included in everything. That was our bargain."
"I'll say it one more time, Tesoro, my treasure."
He only called her by that baby name when he was feeling very affectionate, or very exasperated.
"You are not coming into Mozambique with us."
"You'd go back on your solemn promise?" she accused.
"Without a qualm," he assured her, "if your safety or happiness was involved."
She jumped up from the canvas camp chair and began to prowl around the tent. He watched her with secret pleasure. Her arms were folded over those pert little breasts, and she was frowning heavily. But the frown left no lines on her smooth, plastic skin. In looks, she reminded him of the young Sophia Loren, his favourite actress. Now she stopped beside the camp bed and glared down at him.
"You know I always get my own way," she said. "Why don't you make it easier for both of us and just say I can come?"
"I'm sorry, Tesoro. You aren't coming."
All right. She drew a deep breath. I don't want to do this, Papa, but you'll leave me no choice. I have begun to understand what this means to you, and why you're prepared to pay such a vast sum for a chance to do it. But if I can't go with you, as is my right and my duty, then I will prevent you from going. He chuckled again, easily and unconcernedly. I am serious, deadly serious, Papa. Please don't make me do it. How can you stop me, little girl? He asked. I can tell Sean Courtney what Dr. Andrews told me. Ricardo Montero came to his feet in one lithe, swift movement and seized her arms. What did Andrews tell you? He asked in a voice as thin and cutting as a razor blade. He told me that last November you had a little black spot on your right arm, she said. Instinctively, he put his right arm behind his back, but she went on. It had a pretty name. Melanoma. Like a girl's name. But it wasn't pretty at all, and you left it too late. He cut it out, but the pathologist graded it Clark C. That's 6 months to a year, Papa. That's what he told me. Ricardo Montero sat down on the bed, and his voice was suddenly very weary. When did he tell you?
6 weeks ago. She sat down beside him. That is why I agreed to come to Africa with you. I didn't want to be apart from you for one day of the time we have left, and that's why I'm coming with you into Mozambique.
No, he shook his head, I can't let you.
Then I will tell Sean that at any moment it may reach your brain.
She did not have to elaborate. Andrews had been most graphic as he described the many possible directions the disease could take. If it went to the lungs, it would be death by suffocation. But if it affected the brain or nervous system, it would be either general paralysis or total derangement.
You wouldn't, he said, shaking his head. The last thing in my life that I really want.
You wouldn't deny it me?
Without a qualm, she repeated his own words. If you refuse my right to be with you for every one of those last days, and to be with you at the end, as is the duty of a loving daughter.
I can't let you.
He let his face sink into the cup of his hands, a gesture of defeat that hurt her, and it required all her resolve to keep her tone firm. And I can't let you die alone, she replied.
You don't understand how much I want this thing. It's the last thing in my life. The old bull and I will go together. You don't understand. If you did, you wouldn't prevent me.
I'm not preventing you, she said gently. I want you to have it, if you will let me come with you.
As she said it, they both became aware of a faint vibration in the air, and they looked up together.
Beechcraft, Ricardo murmured. Sean is on his way back to the airstrip. He glanced at his wristwatch. He'll be here within the hour.
And what will you tell him? Claudia asked. Will you tell him that I'm coming with you?
No, Sean let out a bellow. No bloody fear. Forget the idea, Capo. She can't come, and that's absolutely bloody final.
For half a big M, I get to call the shots, Ricardo told him quietly. I say she's coming, so she's coming.
They were standing beside the Toyota. Ricardo and Claudia had met Sean as he drove into camp. Sean drew a breath and glared at father and daughter as they stood side by side confronting him. He saw that both their expressions were set and determined. Sean had been on the point of bellowing again, but with an effort he checked himself.
Be reasonable, Capo, he moderated his tone. You know it's impossible.
They stared at him grimly, closed against argument or reason.
It's war out there. I can't take her.
Claudia comes with us.
The hell she does.
What are you making a fuss about?
Is it because I'm a woman?
Claudia spoke for the first time.
There is nothing a man can do that I can't.
Can you pee standing up?
He wanted to disconcert her, make her lose her temper, but she ignored the crude jibe and went on as though he hadn't spoken.
You've seen me hike. I can stand the heat and the tsetse fly. I'm as good as my father.
He turned from her deliberately and spoke to Ricardo.
As her father, you can't allow it. Can you imagine what would happen to her if she were caught by a gang of Renamo cutthroats?
He saw Ricardo flinch. But Claudia had seen it also, and before he could weaken, she took his hand and spoke up firmly.
Either I go, or nobody goes. And you can kiss your half-million goodbye, Colonel Sean Courtney.